So welcome to the final episode of Rebuilding the Palisades podcast, hosted by DSI. I'm Zach Fagan. This has been an absolute treat getting to bring some of the top architects, builders, interior designers to the table to collectively discuss how we can contribute to rebuilding the Palisades in Malibu. We're joined by the esteemed Corey Taylor, partner at BA Collective. Corey, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It's great.
So tell me, you know, we were talking a little bit about, kind of how you got started, you know, before we started rolling the cameras. Tell me a little bit about how you got into architecture and, you know, was this something that you knew you wanted to do when, you know, when you were a kid, or how were you inspired to become an architect?
It probably wasn't a direct, path necessarily. Like I said, I was raised on a ranch in Wyoming, and so I really didn't know much about architecture growing up at all, so wasn't familiar with it. Just worked in construction and liked to do art and liked engineering, and so it started to coalesce once I got into college and understand that there is a way to be creative and make money. Mm-hmm. And so it ends up kind of resolving itself in that sense, but it's now a complete passion, right? So it's I'm glad I found it.
Yeah, very, very cool. Very cool. So I know there's a little bit of a backstory, but talk to me a little bit how BA Collective came about.
Yeah, originated with the founder Hagi Belzberg, 1998. It's been about 28 years now. He started it doing kind of small houses on his own there in Beverly Hills, and just slowly more and more projects and ramped up to some big commercial, but still a lot of residential. And we've done we're considered like hyper local because 80% of our projects are in Southern California, right? And so just really know the location and the region and have a great basis of people we work with over the last, I've been there 17 years now, and just there's no limit to new projects and things coming down, you know? So it's always something different. And but yeah, that's kind of how it was founded.
Yeah, very cool, very cool. So it obviously, you know, transitioned from, you know, Belzberg Architects over the years, and you know it's expanded, you know, under its leadership. How has this, you know, kind of evolution of the firm influenced the design approach and the culture?
Yeah. Yeah, as it started and the people that we continue to bring in, we're very open with the design process. We don't really go at a project with some standard concept or theory, or it's kind of what we were talking about. When you design something, you design it very specifically for a client and what they want. And so when you look across all the projects and over the history, is like there's no baseline of a commonality, and there's no kind of design style or anything that you can recognize. It really, anybody that we bring into the office influences us, and so that's why we have four partners. We call a collective because it's not about one person; it's about everybody's idea. And we, you know, as new people come in, we say, hey, it doesn't matter if you just got out of school, or if you've been here for 25 years, the best idea will win, you know, and that's what we'll end up doing, a final project. And it can come from the intern many times. And we've just had a recent project where an intern just had a great idea, and
that's awesome.
It's getting built, right? So
that's awesome. That's probably very uplifting for that person as well, to feel like, just because they're, you know, maybe a younger or kind of new and, you know, less experienced member of the team, that their opinion actually does matter. Absolutely. And that yeah. they're heard. Yeah. yeah. No, that's yeah. great to hear.
Yeah. Creativity doesn't have any, you know, any hierarchy to it, right? It can come from anywhere, any time. Mm-hmm. So I think we really just embody that idea.
That's awesome. That's super cool to hear. A lot of, you know, kind of hesitate to say, you know, high end because the term seems so kind of overused, but, you know, a higher echelon, you know, kind of well-known firm, you know, or entity, you know, a lot of times it's kind of thought, you know, like, oh, they, you know, there's kind of a, right. A snootiness, as it were. We're like, only these individuals have good ideas, yeah, exactly. and you're not, yeah. you're not paid to think, kind of approach, you yeah. know? And, yeah. I think there have been a lot of great ideas over the years that have been brought, you know, by folks that necessarily would have thought would have a great idea, you know, given they have a different position, you know, but I'd love to hear that about the firm. I didn't realize it was quite that inclusive.
That's how you have to, that's how you evolve and stay fresh. And, you know, you have to bring in the kids from school. And as they come out with new ideas, it's just utilizing that as well. And so I think a healthy firm kind of has to have that fresh ideas and
sure.
and new thinking. Otherwise, you'll get old fast.
Yeah, you'll stagnate, yeah. right? Yeah, yeah, no one wants stagnation. So, you know, you've worked on a range of projects, right? From, you know, schools, public schools, hospitals, high-rise condos, you know, et cetera. How do you adapt your design process to such a varied, you know, array of different types of projects?
Yeah. You know, it does come down to the context and, you know, trying to do the right thing for the location, right? So depending on the project and where it's at, you just weigh in all those different influences that help you define the design. And then again, clients are a strong element, budget also. And, you know, it doesn't matter what type of project, type of building it is. You approach design the same way no matter what, you know. And if it's used in one way or another, it's not super critical unless it has a very strong impact on the design, you know. But we approach almost any building, any type of building, the same way, with just be aware of your surroundings, what's influencing the true nature of the design, mm-hmm. and then always just trying to think of the next level. You know, you want to build for 100 years. It's you'd never want to design for what's hot or trendy now, or, you know, it's like, how is this going to stand the test of time for 40, 50, 100 years? And so always thinking about that kind of timelessness as well. So.
Sure. Yeah. So DSI is currently collaborating with BA Collective on a very exciting project on Sorbonne.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about the firm's vision for this project. You know, yeah. it's super unique. Yeah. There's a lot of really different components and aspects of the property and the design that I hear haven't been done before. Some really unique design, you know, components in there that you guys are integrating into the design. So talk a little bit about that and kind of what the kind of, not the motivation, but the idea behind, you know, the concept behind the property was.
Right. You know, we tend to cringe at spec homes, right? It's like, it's not something that we have done, you know, a lot of in the past. And this is one of our first big self-developments of a custom home, right? So a lot of risk and hopefully a lot of reward, but the idea behind it was to try to design a home that is meant for somebody, first of all, right? That it's just not kind of some generic thing that appeals to a broad range of people. Obviously, you have to have somebody in mind of who you're designing for. And we were constantly putting on the developer hat and the architect hat because is it for us? Is it something that we want to really do? And we're trying to tread that fine line, you know. The idea behind the house is just being really honest with materials and innovating with artistic ways of using those natural materials in a different way. And it becomes very much about a sustainability and wellness idea behind it too, is that we're, there's very little paint, there's very little, there's almost no plastics, you know, it's all a natural material based out of, used with artisans out of Mexico, right? So we have a partner that's sourcing a lot of Mexico products, you know, our stones, our wood flooring, all this stuff is kind of done very specifically from small mom and pop companies, you know, and so we're using really great artisanal aspects to how we both approach the design, how we're creating a narrative of who it's for and what it's about. So that bleeds into some of the innovative uses of, you know, the whole exterior facade is a customized stone cladding, you know, so not only is it fire resistant, it can be taken off and reused 100 times. It'll last for 100 years, and it's never been done before on a house. So things like that, just kind of that idea bleeds into everything we do, you know, so there's a lot of unique and new things that excite us as architects and hopefully will pay off as developers.
Yeah. Yeah. Without doubt. I noticed also when I first looked at the plans, I thought, wow, this is an interesting gutter system.
Yeah.
You know, it has gutter. You have to have gutters, right? But there are no eaves.
Right.
And you can't see the gutter from the street. It's totally integrated into the roof in a very, you know, unique way. So that stuck out to me as well. There are a couple other design aspects that stuck out when I first walked through the building, when it was in the framing phase. There are few rooms in the building. It's got a lot of wide open spaces.
Yeah.
It's what, 13,000 square feet or so. So it's pretty expansive. Yeah. And many times in homes that are that size, there's just a lot of compartmentalization, right? Just little rooms. And it feels like there's just a bunch of rooms here. The house doesn't feel that big really, because it's just a bunch of small spaces.
Yeah.
But you guys were able to integrate a floor plan that kept the sight lines up, that, you know, didn't have to use columns.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of columns and posts in the way and kind of getting, you know, in the way of the sight lines or, you know, the kind of path of travel through the property, specifically downstairs. You know, when you go down the stairs, you hit that bar area and then it's just wide open all the way to the end. It's a huge space.
Yeah.
How were you able to, was it mainly structural steel that you were using to get there, or what were some of the ways that you were able to achieve those large spaces?
It's the exact opposite, which is surprising. As you bring that up, that, you know, it's a great feature, and I was just thinking, it's like, there's no steel in it. It's almost, they're literally a series of boxes that have been extruded, and we designed it very specifically to be cost effective and easily framed out of your standard wood products, you know. So there is very little steel in it, and it's created in a way where you can kind of see from one end to the other, obviously, but it embraces the property. And again, the geometry and the nature of the property, the trees, the neighbors, everything defined that formal quality to it. And this thing has a big kind of hug around the main feature of the pool and this big deck, and then the views out to the city. So the context and the site kind of created all that, but it was literally the idea of trying to keep a very economical and rational structure. We don't have huge cantilevers. We don't have a lot of expensive structure in it, and it's just these beautifully positioned boxes that open up, and you can literally see. I was just there the other day, over 100 feet from basically when you get in from your garage, you can see your formal dining room to the other end, and so you feel this expansiveness as you walk through it, and it's just kind of freedom.
Yeah. You know? No, it's very cool and unique. Look, your Santa Monica studio uses, you know, mass timber and some sustainable systems. What motivated these choices, and how do they reflect your commitment to sustainability?
Yeah. It's also just a natural progress. Like I said, that markets, public opinion, everything's moving towards, you know, sustainability, and it's just the right thing to do. You know, the more you get beat over the head over it, it's like, hey guys, we are literally killing the earth in these ways, and buildings are the number one reason, and how do we do all this better? You know, and so energy becomes one, and better construction, construction that lasts longer. You know, we've all probably been around those terrible 80s and 70s structures that are basically made out of cardboard, right? They all get torn down.
Yeah.
And so mass timber finally has become viable in so many ways. And we've done glue lambs in a different version of mass timber for thousands of years, right? It's been the main staple of building material. And so new engineering techniques, along with new policy allowances for, you know, seismic connections and the way that those are built, that technology is allowed for a better use of that material, and so it just became the right thing to do. You know, it's you, sometimes you don't even think about it. It's like, oh yeah, why use steel and concrete when you can use wood? And you know, then. Like our office has very little sheetrock. We didn't have to paint on anything on the inside. The day they put it up, which they put it up much faster because it was just a kit of parts of heavy timber pieces that just put together in about a week. And then as soon as they enclosed it with the windows and door, you could move in. There was really no finishing left to be done. So the logic behind that material is pretty simple and straightforward. It's like, why wouldn't anybody do this?
Sure. You know? Yeah. Well, I haven't heard a building referred to as a kit of parts before.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's my background too. Cause I used to build airplane hangars, and they were out of steel, and it literally was like 20 pieces that come on a truck and you just bolt it all together.
Right.
Right. And so it's effectively the same thing with heavy timber, is that they prefab and engineer and all those pieces, and they came in on one big truck and they unloaded it and bolted it up in about a week.
Wow.
Right. So
technically you could unbolt it and move it somewhere if you really wanted to.
That's the point too. Wow. Right. Reuse it.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, we've all faced, you know, some challenges, you know, in our career. We've had, you know, challenging client or really challenging site or project or something about the project that was, you know, that really stuck out, you know, as a, you know, a big hump, you know, to get over. What are some of the, or one specific challenge that you faced in your career as an architect?
It comes up more and more, and maybe it's because I'm getting old and kind of tired of it. It is the regulations and the restrictions that come up. You know, building codes are meant for a purpose, obviously, but I think I just get a little bit tired of some of the certain regulations. It's like, why are they doing this? And what's the point? And you're designing for the 1%, and then you have to build in a whole lot of extra budget for something that either doesn't get used or it's not really advancing the construction or the evolution of how we should live. And so regulations from building departments and this, I think that's also affecting why it's so expensive to build here, right? It takes a long time to get approvals. And those agencies, I think today is probably our biggest challenge in general. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's always clients and budget, and that's kind of the next two big ones as well, right? Is that money? It would be, I think, the typical frustration in almost every architect's world in life is, one, we don't get to build a lot, right? You know, a project, if you see it through, is at least 3 to 5, sometimes 10 years, right? Mm-hmm. So you only have so many of the big ones in you. And then you end up designing thousands of structures, thousands of buildings on speculation, and just it's like they don't get built. So you're lucky to get, 10, 15 buildings and ideas out there.
For sure. Yeah. It occurred to me recently in a conversation that I had with, I think it was with an expediter. I'm pretty sure it was an expediter that I was talking to. And we were talking about building codes, and he said, you know, one of the reasons, and I'd never heard this before, but as soon as he said it, I realized, oh, duh, of course, this makes sense, that part of the reason why LA City, and I want your thoughts and opinion on this as well, part of the reason why, you know, LEDBS has, you know, the amount of like specific code, you know, restrictions, and they're so stringent in Beverly Hills, you know, like these areas that have all of these, what seem like really, you know, heavy lifts, to meet certain, you know, code requirements. Why is that? He said, well, part of it is because LA is so litigious and they don't want to be getting sued because they approved some permit and then something happened, whatever. And all of a sudden, you know, they're getting sued because someone's, you know, cantilever deck like cracked, it was too heavy or something like that, you know? So, you know, what are some of your, you know, kind of thoughts and opinion on, that component, you know, just the litigious nature of, you know, some of the residents of LA and the correlation between that and, the complexity of the code in Southern California.
Yeah, that's absolutely, I think, correct to say too, is that yes, there's a lot of lawyers that live here. And you know, obviously we are in a world of a lot of extreme conditions too, right? So there's logic to much of the code, and being just the inclusive nature too, is that you want something that anybody can enjoy if you're working with a public project. And that's, I think, also good to make sure that, hey, a single family home that's built for a person shouldn't have the same kind of restrictions and regulations as a public building. So defining those very clearly is one thing. But, you know, we've got earthquakes, and we've got heavy rains now, and we've got the fires and all the other extreme conditions that we're living with. So that's a whole nother level of just being, you know, cognizant and responsible with the codes and construction. And there's a lot of people, and that's the other thing, is that we have a huge socioeconomic condition, you know, and that ties into it as well, is that you've got all different types of people living together in this location. So I think that complexity on some hand is necessary. But I think it's how they implement it or facilitate it, right? Is like certain things just need to be looked at in a different way, or a little bit of red tape needs to be removed so you can get things built faster, right? Without creating too much liability, you know? And I lived in New York for 7-8 years, and they can self-certify, architects can self-certify their projects, meaning that you don't really have to take it to the building department to get approval. As long as you're building as of right for the zoning, you know, don't go too high, don't go too wide. But literally a high rise, a 20-story luxury condo, we self-certified the construction of it. And so that means we can start construction the next day after you design it.
Wow.
And start building it. And it's this inspector, you know, so you become liable as the architect, and then you also put a little bit more liability on the actual inspection of it, right? So if those stairs aren't to code, or if you know your fire egress and everything has to be per code, but it gets addressed during construction and while you're building it. So there's ways to speed up the process without increasing liability, and other cities do it, and there's precedent there.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Self-certification. Wow, how about that?
They've been talking about it with the fire rebuild. The mayor has, and they're mulling it over. And I think that would be a huge change in the future accessibility of construction in LA. It should change prices too.
Theoretically, I was going to say theoretically, it would lower the cost.
Uh-huh.
So it would shift some burden of responsibility, accountability over to architects. But you're already licensed.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. When somebody starts pulling out lawsuits, it hits everybody anyway.
Right.
Right. So, and if the city is worried about their liability, it reduces it. Right. And that's a good way of just saying, hey, we didn't do a plan check on it. Go to the architect, go to the engineer. And we are already in that line of liability. So you might as well just make it faster then, and we'll just self-certify ourselves.
Why not? Right? Why not?
So it should be a win-win for the city if they do it.
No, certainly. I mean, anything that can be done to kind of expedite the process while, you know, keeping in line with code requirements, et cetera, you know, seems like a smart thing to do, given the kind of magnitude of the problem that we face.
Discover why we're the most awarded home technology firm in the U.S. Our design-centric approach transforms your space with effortless control of lighting, motorized shades, audio, video, and more. Our friendly experts guide you every step of the way, no tech speak, just smart, stunning simplicity. We provide years of care from our award-winning service and support team. Experience technology that feels as good as it looks.
So kind of shifting gears back toward the fires, what were some of your immediate thoughts upon learning, not just that, you know, there was a massive fire in Altadena and the Palisades, but just, you know, what would the impact be, kind of how, you know, I had my thoughts, and I knew when I saw the smoke that they were really big fires. And of course I was glued to the television and glued to, you know, my news feed for, you know, the immediate, you know, kind of impact and, you know, the following days and weeks. But, you know, what were some of your initial thoughts when you found out that this was happening, besides shock and disbelief, you know, concern for, you know, the human factor? What else is going through your head when you heard about this?
I think you kind of nailed most of the immediate stuff. I think as the second wave of, okay, now all these homes are gone, how does that truly impact the rest of the city? And you know, as an optimist, you're always thinking about what's next. You know, okay, it's an unbelievable thing, and it was conditions that were absolutely unprecedented. And you kind of think back, it's like, okay, why did it all happen? You're trying to do the kind of the forensic analysis, like if it was a different conditions with urbanity and the suburban connection with nature, and should we have done control burning and managed that, you know? And that's how I grew up, is like, you know, in Wyoming, fire meant renewal, and it was necessary kind of constantly to burn back stuff and protect other things and to allow other things grow. And so your second thought of once everybody's safe, you're saying, hey, you know, what's going to come back and why should it come back? And so there was a lot of conflicting. It's like, oh, let's do it better. Let's bring it back better and different. And then there's also like, will it come back? You know, it's like, should it come back at all?
Yeah.
So, well, yeah, a lot of conflicting back and forth. And like I said, I had close friends there, you know, in the Altadena one. So they all lost their homes and dealing with it. And they, you know, they're in suburban, that's a suburban world, and it's really close to nature. And so yeah, if it wasn't a landslide or something else, it's kind of constant. Yeah. How do you deal with nature and live around it?
Yeah.
So
no, without doubt. You know, I was shocked by, you know, the magnitude of it, but when the winds were so high for so many days in a row, we all knew the fire danger is always, you know, elevated when there's, you know, when there's, you know, extra high winds. But these were bananas.
Yeah.
The winds, it wasn't just high winds, you know, 30, 40 mile an hour. And we're talking hurricane force winds here. That was a category 1 or 2 hurricane.
Yeah.
You know, force winds that we were dealing with. And once things were on fire, coupled with that wind,
yeah,
and the inability to get aircraft in the air, it was just the confluence of just the absolute worst, you know, variables all at once.
And the fact that we were 3/4 of the way through the rainy season and not a drop. You know, if there was just a half an inch rainfall, you know, a month ago, it would probably changed a lot
for
of
sure
things, right?
Yeah.
So it's just those things all added up. And it,
yeah, no, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, how would you approach the rebuilding process in the Palisades to kind of ensure more resilience and sustainability in the area?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, to be honest, you go through that, and obviously each individual new home or new structure that gets built is going to have a number of things that they're going to implement that will help, right? That you think back of, yes, that's 100-year-old homes that were there, almost 100, and there was just a lot of fuel that existed, old codes and old, you know. So you know that the new build back is going to be so much better already, right? But you also think about the other things that helped that, and it's the defensible space, you know, between the buildings, and then there's the fuel of the shrubs and the trees. You know, there's eucalyptus trees that are actually excrete combustible, you know, fluid in them. So there's certain trees that are even that promote the fire that we planted that are invasive and not natural. So being a lot more cognizant of the natural environment of what's a fire resistant tree, you know, the oak trees and the pine trees, most of them are there and didn't burn. And so that type of fuel, I think, helps. And you think also back is that, you know, it's a suburban community. Both Altadena and Palisades are a suburban community, and it's low density. It means there's a lot of space between homes. It means for more shrubs and plantings and stuff that can catch fire. And if it was a higher density and more urban environment, you know, you think, because I live in Hollywood, and there's just less trees and less space between them. And I was thinking, could a fire rip through this in the same way? And it's like, maybe, maybe not. Maybe we're more protected because we are a tighter urban and denser environment, right? And there's no space for those fires to just, you know, go off continually and one after another, just, you know. So it's, you know, thinking about how that all gets built back, obviously the market is going to dictate, you know, all the different financial issues and the fact that it's still baseline zoning and planning. They aren't changing the policies on build back, and you're going to get single family homes in the same lots and that's very similar rebuild, and they'll just be more fire resistive, but you're not going to change the overall, I guess, liability or the, if the next fire comes out, it's going to be a similar situation, right? Because you're just rebuilding what's there. What's there?
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's a dilemma, and you would hope that you'd be able to change those things, but it's a hard push to tell everybody. It's like, nope, you can't come back. We're not allowing you to build here. Or, hey, these are all going to just be high rises and a concrete jungle. So those things. Yeah. You know, you aren't going to change any of that.
Yeah. Either. So. No, I know. There's a lot of conversations about what the Palisades are going to look like when they're rebuilt. And in Altadena, yeah, a lot of craftsmen homes were lost. You know, a lot of beautiful, really unique, cool old homes, you know. And, you know, are those going to get rebuilt? Are we going to rebuild these craftsmen homes? I mean, the generation that built those homes is long gone.
Yeah.
You know, they're not building like that anymore.
Yeah.
So there's been, you know, we've had a lot of conversations about the character of these communities and, you know, how the architectural design of the different homes, you know, make up that character, the physical appearance of the community. Of course, the resilience really lies in the people that live there and their determination, you know, to move back again. But yeah, it's interesting to see, and just kind of to riff on that a little bit. There's been discussions as well about how long this is all going to take. I'm hearing a decade more, you know. What are your thoughts on what it's really going to take from, you know, a time perspective, you know, to build these areas back?
Yeah. Yeah. I think 10 years to be back to normal, but I think 5 years will be a huge, huge change. You know, typically when we're designing and starting construction of a home, we allow for a year of design and potentially another year for entitlements to get the approval. So if you can squeeze that down and take a year and a half out of that, and so the construction is 2 years or 18 months, if depending on the level of complexity. So in 3 years, I would see a huge change. And this is all based off of, do people have enough money to rebuild? If they don't, they're selling it. And then are developers going to come in and do it for them? And as long as people aren't incentivized just to sit on the land and wait for it to go up, which is, you know, our tax system is kind of built in. Well, let's just have a land bank and sit on it, and we don't have to develop it, and it'll just go up in price. So a lot of these factors will play into how fast it comes back and to what level. But I think 3 to 5 years, we'll see a huge, huge change. But that doesn't you know, the houses are one thing. It's the other infrastructure too. You know, there's a lot of commercial buildings, a lot of community structures, churches. Those things, they may be lost forever. And the character, as you say, the character, yes, being nostalgia for those old buildings and the great architecture that you know, it's part of me aches to do that type of structure again in construction, but then also I'm forward thinking. It's like, hey, you're going to find really beautiful complexity and interest in the, if you have a lot of different architects design the new homes, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's going to have a different take on it. And if we can allow for some freedom in the design and some in the zoning and, you know, we will get, I think, a really beautiful communities if it's new too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I don't disagree with you. So obviously, you know, there's some kind of new materials and, you know, design strategies that are going to be applied here. You know, what are some of the kind of, you know, low hanging fruit, as it were, in your opinion, regarding, you know, rebuilding strategies and, you know, alternative materials and stuff like that?
Yeah. Yeah. This is tough. I've been thinking about that too, because again, as we were stating, the industry has a hard time evolving and moving forward quickly. And we're still rooted. We still build a house the same we did 200 years ago, or, you know, it's a bunch of guys with hammers and nails and you're putting wood studs together. So, wood, steel, glass, concrete, those haven't changed much, but what is hopeful is, some of the prefabrication techniques that are out there. Obviously, the 3D digital printing, you know, large format digital printing, which is also fire resistive because it's a cementitious based material. So those can create really unique advances and innovation. Love to do, but it's still not there yet, and to do it quickly and at scale. So in 5 years, we'll probably be doing more and more of it. But as far as specific materials, we're still quite limited to being both sustainable and fire resistive. It's, you know, love concrete, but it's not. If everybody did concrete, I think that would be a hard sustainable push. Yeah. You know, so. It's just balancing those things. But yeah, there's nothing really new on the table as far as materials and how it gets installed. But I think there's, potential in the technology, you know, the systems of the building, you know, how we control it and protect it in that way. I think there's a lot of, options and different ways of doing that.
Yeah. What about, you know, what's your vision for kind of subs and architects and contractors kind of working together, you know, to be more efficient in, you know, in the rebuild process? You know, we're going to have, you know, parades of dump trucks and, you know, fill dirt trucks and excavation equipment and, trades, you know, vehicles coming in and out. We're going to have deliveries happening. We're going to have, you know, material being removed and taken to, you know, a recycling facility or, right, you know, a landfill or, you know, or whatever. Do you have any thoughts or kind of ideas that the community might be able to implement, to make that process more collaborative and more efficient?
Gosh, that is a good question. I, you know, there, yeah, in a perfect world, there would be like this shared resource in a way where if your neighbor's building a house and bought a bunch of lumber, it's like, get it in bulk and share the use of it. And so, yeah, there might be some way of, we were thinking about, it's like, oh, we have, we have in the office 5-6 projects, and we're looking at even trying to efficiently design those and share details and work through that quicker, because it's repetitive, right? And so you're kind of scaling up one house. You might as well just do 4 or 5 houses. But you know, it's never that easy, and it's a bit of a utopia. So I'm not sure if there is any viable kind of collaborative options out there. I was just thinking, it's like a lot of this is coming down to just like business as usual, you know. It's like,
yeah,
you approach a project, you know, you've got a client and you've got certain parameters and they have a budget, and if they all aligned and you could do one after the other, or they all came at the same time, great. But I think it's going to be sporadic, right? Somebody, you know, you're going to build one house here, and then 2 years later, the next one will come in, and 2-3 years later. So they're just, it's going to be a prolonged construction process with very little ability to kind of consolidate all that, I guess. So the efficiencies are going to be tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about maintaining quality throughout that process?
Yeah. I think that's the question too, right? It's going to tax the city on making sure inspections and everything is up to speed. And so again, it might come back to that self-certification. And I don't know if that would help quality or hinder it. It's hard to say. I think quality also is a bit nebulous on what that means as far as, you know, I think we're getting better and better materials, and there's potential prefabricated elements that could be done offsite, or, you know, that's, you could, you know, I don't know if you know, like SIP panels or structurally insulated panels that are pre-engineered.
Wall systems, ceiling systems.
Exactly, right? And they come and they're highly engineered and really robust, and they do cost a little bit more on the front end, but you could tilt them up and put up a lot of house, you know, and a lot of different projects quickly. So there's other, I think, opportunities to investigate at scale when you're talking about a lot of different homes.
Yeah. The engineered kind of factory made panel and component conversations come up more than a few times.
Yeah.
And I'm personally a big fan, because I see a lot of waste when I go to a job site, and I've been going, you know, to job sites since I was a teenager, you know, 14 or so. And the thing that strikes me every single time is that roll off
that's
at the front of the site. And I walk past it and I can't help but, you know, I'll crawl up and just look in there and see, you know, what's been thrown in the trash.
Yeah.
And of course there's, you know, sawed off, you know, chunks, you know, where someone's making a stairway or something. Not much you could do with those little pieces.
Right.
But then I see, well, there's a 12-foot piece of EMT. What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
Look at that roll of copper over here.
Yeah.
And then that roll off is full, you know, 5 tons of material, whatever it is, 10 tons of material, you know, and then another, you know, empty bin comes, and then that one gets full, and then another one. And this just happens over and over for every property. And you've got the trips out there for all the trades. You've got all of the trucks that have to go out there and deliver materials and pick up trash, the dust, the noise, and everything that's created on site where you've got all these people working. And I don't know anyone that woke up in the morning and said, wow, it's really quiet. I'd love some construction noise in my life. Yeah. You know, so building that stuff in a factory, and then just having a, you know, 1 or 2 big truckloads of stuff come in, and look, there's 30-40% of the home is framed up all of a sudden. Well, that seems to really make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So I personally would love to see more of that. I think that's something that the community could really benefit from.
Yeah.
And you can still have luxury, right?
Yeah.
Just because part of the home was built in a factory somewhere, you know, doesn't mean that it isn't, you know, can't be a luxury home, of course. Lots of components are built in factories. Why not, you know, wall and ceiling systems?
To your point, there could be a whole nother market out there just for scavengers alone, right? If these construction sites, again, I've seen all that debris and waste, and it's just like there's enough material in there to build another home for somebody else practically.
Sure. To build something.
Right?
Yeah, doghouse or something can be built. Yeah,
having some system instead of just throwing it in a dumpster and then taking it to the landfill and allowing people to scavenge possibly even. You know, we were just thinking about when you drive through the Palisades and all you see are chimneys, you know, the old chimneys, and like, there is a lot of reusable material there, and it's just a kind of a beautiful narrative too, is like we're reusing, you know, some of these old homes and building new ones with it, right? So
yeah,
we're looking to do one house that's just reusing all the chimney brick.
Wow. And very cool.
So
no, that's commendable.
Yeah.
I did see where someone was taking the time to go and save all of this unique tile in some of the properties in Altadena and in the Palisades. You know, unique stuff that you just can't get anymore.
Right.
You know, it's old, historic stuff. So, you know, chiseling that stuff out of there and saving it, it's like, you know, let's do that. You know, that's a great idea. Look, Corey, this has been a fantastic conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed, you know, the time with you today. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about briefly before we wrap up the episode, or any resource that you think homeowners could benefit from?
Not at this time. I think there was one question you had in there about how do you handle insurance, homeowners, and the city. And I was thinking, it's like, you know, you deal with the insurance with patience and perseverance. You just got to keep on it. You work with homeowners with a lot of empathy, and you deal with the city and entitlements with humble defiance. You know, it's just you got to deal with them, but you know, push back a little bit and try to get more out of it. But yeah, I think it's a journey that everybody is. It's going to be individualized and unique for everybody to go through. So yeah, it's hard putting broad brushes and just try to say this will work for everybody.
Yeah,
it's going to be different.
Sure. Well, thank you again for coming out, and we look forward to continuing to work with you and the rest of your team over at BA Collective.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right.